You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and today we're talking about ways to extend the growing season. Johanna Oosterwyk is back with us. She's the instructional manager of the D.C. Smith Greenhouse on the UW-Madison campus. And so we'll talk with her about her work, but also she will take your questions about tropical plants as well. Have you thought about adding a greenhouse to your property? What questions do you have? What would you like to know about growing plants year-round? We can talk about that for sure. Join the conversation. You can call us at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Johanna Oosterwyk, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hi, Larry. It's great to see you again.
Well, nice to have you here. And the D.C. Smith Greenhouse is where you work. Tell us about the greenhouse.
Well, we're the instructional greenhouse for the College of Agriculture. So students in plant science classes come to the greenhouse to either grow plants or sometimes just to visit them. We've got a class of undergraduates in there this morning learning to propagate plants through cuttings and seeding. So they're hard at work just outside my door.
You know, a couple of days ago, I couldn't resist stopping in at the conservatory. And I was like, oh, my gosh. I walked in and I wanted to immediately sit down and just sit back and not go to work.
Yes, we get a lot of visitors. The greenhouses are open weekdays, both to students, faculty, staff, and the public. And we love to have visitors stop by.
It was a wonderful place. There were a couple of people in the conservatory just sitting there reading, and the water and the plants and everything. It was just wonderful. Something that's, I think, fairly new in the D.C. greenhouse is aquaponics.
It is very new. It's not actually started yet. We are building an aquaponics system. So I'm excited about how that's going to go.
So describe what you've got, the system.
Right. So I'm going to back up a little bit. And we got funding for the system because of the students. The students are really the ones who pushed for this. I've had some experience with hydroponics, but we had a student group called Engineers for a Sustainable World, and they got grant funding through a campus program called the Campus Green Fund, and that bought us an aquaponics system, which the students have been working for the past month to put together. And they're taking their time, going methodically, and hopefully in another week or two, we will be ready to put in the plants, which we started from seed, so we have little baby lettuce plants ready to go in there. But more exciting, we will have fish as well. And if you're not familiar with an aquaponics system, it's growing plants hydroponically, so growing plants in water culture, but the nutrient source is the fish waste. Fish waste is high in ammonia, and the nitrogen in ammonia is one of the key nutrients for plants. In fact, it's the nutrient that they need the most of. And the water just takes the fish waste away from the fish, where it would harm the fish. If you are an aquarium owner, you know you need to filter your water. We're going to use the plants to filter out that excess nitrogen, grow the plants, have lettuce, and maybe even some fillets of fish on the side, too.
Well, how large of an operation is this? I mean, how big is the system? Is it...
It's actually a pretty small system considering it's taking up half of one of our greenhouses. We've got a 100-gallon fish tank and 2 4-foot by 6-foot tanks for growing plants in, which I think will be fine for us. It's already previously I've been growing lettuce in hydroponic tanks that gave me 2 foot by 4 foot, so it's 8 square feet. 32 square feet of growing space, and I'm going to have a little bit more than that in this upcoming system.
Well, I was on your website, the D.C. Smith Greenhouse website, and there was a little feature about the fact that you grew 300 pounds of cukes, tomatoes, and lettuce in over a 6-month period from January.
Oh, yeah, you saw that.
Oh, yeah.
That was so in the spring, I teach a class in greenhouse cultivation, and I kept some of the plants going after the semester was over. So the data that I had was from January through June. And in 6 months, yeah, we ended up with over 300 pounds of cherry tomatoes, cucumbers, and heads of lettuce, as well as a few bulbs of radishes as well.
Well, it just brings me to the whole process of adding a greenhouse to your garden. If you're, there are a lot of people listening who might be interested in a greenhouse. What are some basic things to think about when considering adding a greenhouse to your garden?
Yeah, it's a dream for a lot of folks. I know if I weren't coming here to work every day, I would certainly be considering one as an addition to my house or my garden. First thing to think about is space. How much room do you have available in your yard or adjacent to your house? And also location. So if you're going to start a greenhouse, obviously you want to rely on natural sunlight. So you need an area that is relatively unshaded. Best locations, if you're doing a lean-to on your house, would be the south side and the west side. Those get the best sun exposure. And a space that gets, at least half a day unshaded out in your yard. So I would think, first of all, about how much area do I have and what kind of location I could put a greenhouse in.
And how would you, I was thinking about a friend of mine, or some friends of mine who actually, they built a house and they added right onto it a greenhouse, and they also plunked a hot tub in it.
That's the dream.
That would definitely be the dream. And it's such a setting. You sit in that hot tub in December with all those plants around.
Sounds wonderful.
Yeah, it sounds wonderful, but most of us are not going to be in a financial position to put a hot tub in the greenhouse, even though I think it's a wonderful idea. So we've got space considerations. What other kinds of things do you want to think about?
Well, think about what you want to do with your greenhouse. Do you want it to be an extension of your home? Thinking more along the lines of a sunroom where you would sit and enjoy the atmosphere. Or are you really looking at hardcore growing plants or kind of a mix of those two things? Because that really directs the type of materials that you use and the type of plants that you can grow. If you really want to go, full bore and say grow citrus throughout the year. I've had some folks ask me about, setting up maybe a lean-to greenhouse on their home so they can have their fresh oranges. That's going to be a very different kind of greenhouse than one where you want to be able to sit in, say, a conservatory area and sit among your tropical plants and enjoy the humidity and the moisture from them. So that one has more of a focus on human comfort in the space versus intensively growing plants, for example. The primary thing there is going to be what kind of glazing you put on it. The glazings that your architect or your builder are going to want to use will let less light through, which is good for energy savings. They let less light in, but they also let less heat or infrared radiation out. So if you're getting a sunroom added, you're probably going to be presented with different types of low energy or low E glass. And those are great for saving energy on your heating, but they won't give the plants as much light as, say, they would really like. But if you're looking for a sunroom, someplace that you would like to sit and enjoy, those kinds of environments will also keep you cooler in the summer, too, and keep your space from overheating. So we're sort of looking at, two far ends of the spectrum. If you really want to look at glazings for plant production, you want to look at some of the thinner types of glass. You want to look at glass that is as clear as possible and lets as much light energy in, or maybe even some kinds of transparent plastics that aren't as clear, but then again, you're interested in what light can get to your plants, maybe not can you look out and see a nice view. So you're kind of have two opposing spectrums. What do you get for human comfort versus what do you get for plant growth? And then you try and find where you are best suited along that spectrum.
Yeah.
Are you growing plants or for people or a little bit of both?
I have a friend, I think I've mentioned this on the show in the past, Chuck Johnson found a boat hoist. And you know what a boat hoist kind of looks like? It's a long, you know, sort of lengthy structure. And he put plastic over the top of the boat hoist and made himself kind of a greenhouse to get an earlier start on the season.
Yeah, I could definitely see that.
And it works pretty darn well. What kinds of plants are good at acclimating to growing in a greenhouse?
Things that you could grow in a greenhouse through the winter. Well, if you don't mind adding some extra light, you could go ahead and grow peppers and tomatoes all year round. But realize that just like the weather gets cooler, the light, well, this weekend is going to be an example of that. The days get shorter, so we have less light available. If you want to grow fruiting crops, you will definitely need to add supplemental electric lights throughout the winter. If you don't want to have to do that, you know, any kind of houseplant, if you want to set up a conservatory area, you'll have better light than you probably would in your home. You know, with this, if you move just a few feet away from the window, you lose half of the light. But in a greenhouse, you have windows all around you. So you can certainly grow all kinds of tropical houseplants really well, but you can also grow some fruiting and vegetable crops if you're willing to add on a few extra pieces of equipment.
Johanna Oosterwijk, our guest today, the instructional manager of the D.C. Smith Greenhouse on the campus of UW-Madison, talking a bit with her about extending the growing season. And it's fun talking about greenhouses, and there are other things that can work as well, and we'll talk about those too with her. You can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Jill Nadeau is our producer today, A. Emily Ralph, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Johanna Oosterwijk, the instructional manager of the D.C. Smith Greenhouse on the UW-Madison campus. Questions for her, give a call at 800-642-1234, or you could email us, twoideas@wpr.org. And let's take a call from John in Boaz. John, thanks for calling.
I wanted to know which light is best for growing plants. Would it be an LED lamp or an incandescent infrared heat lamp?
All right. That's actually not too difficult to answer. An infrared heat lamp isn't going to help you grow plants. By its definition, it's going to give you heat. And plants want to photosynthesize, turn light energy into sugars, but the light energy, the electromagnetic radiation that they use is from 400 to 700 nanometers. And an infrared light is going to give you around 780 nanometers. So it's outside of the spectrum that they use for photosynthesis, for creating sugars and for growth. So an incandescent bulb is going to be very energy inefficient. Even if you just use one of the standard, you know, old time incandescent lamps, they don't give you the light intensity, the strength of energy that you need. The newer LED fixtures are now replacing most of our other types of lights in greenhouses. In fact, we used to use high-pressure sodium fixtures, which are a type of metal halide bulb in the greenhouses, and those put out quite a bit of light as well. That's one of the reasons they were less efficient at producing the light energy that plants need. They turned a lot of the electrical input into heat energy, which warmed up the plants nicely, but did not actually give them the energy that they need to grow. So LED fixtures are really where the majority of indoor growers are moving. Now, they are far more expensive than other types of lamps, but at this point, they are proven to be more efficient, and that's really the way that the light-producing manufacturing industry is going. So you're going to find it harder and harder to find other types of light. We are still seeing a fair number of fluorescent light fixtures still being produced, but I definitely would never recommend to someone to grow with an incandescent bulb. And you can find good quality LED lamps at this point. Look for something that has a 5-year warranty. Even 5 years ago, we were having trouble with everybody jumping on the LED bandwagon. So you would have a hard time maybe finding fixtures that would last and give you the return on investment of that higher price. But at this point, you can find a lot of good quality fixtures out there, and look for something that the manufacturer is still going to stand behind, that they will say, yeah, for 5 years, I'm willing to replace this or repair it. It's not necessarily the LEDs themselves that go bad. It's the electrical driver that tends to break down sooner. But if you're looking at a fixture, look for one that has a warranty of 5 years or so. Just proof that the manufacturer is willing to stand behind their product. The DC Smith greenhouse just last year replaced 80% of our high-pressure sodium lights with LED fixtures. So I've been growing under LEDs myself for over a year.
Yeah, and it really does work well. Although for the DC Smith greenhouse, that would have taken a little chunk of money.
It did. We got a grant, the same campus grant agency Green Fund that paid for our aquaponics system a year ago, gave us about 60% of the funding for our new LED fixtures. The rest of it came out of our annual budget and a little bit from donations to our 25th anniversary. The greenhouse is now over 25 years old. It opened officially in 1997.
Janine in Rhinelander has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Janine.
Morning. So many years ago, when I was a student at UW Stevens Point, one of my science teachers had taken us out to his home during the winter, and we were harvesting carrots in the winter. He had them under bales of hay, and it was so impressive that I wanted to try that now as a grown adult. And my husband and I have tried several ways, and they keep freezing on us. Now, again, I'm in Rhinelander, and we've tried bales of hay. 1 year, when we pulled the bales away, there had been mice under there, or a mole or something, and chewed all the carrots. So how did that happen, or how is that possible, or is it possible up where I am?
It is possible. You may not be able to get through to the sort of dead of winter, but you can certainly get, you know, a month or so of season extension. Probably the easiest thing for you to do would be what's called a low tunnel. So you've seen, you know, greenhouse hoop houses that are walk-in structures. It's sort of a mini version of that. But you would want to put on kind of multiple layers and maybe some straw inside, anything you can do to insulate those plants. After about next week, we get to the point in the day length where it's less than 10 hours. And gardeners call this the Persephone period, in reference to the Greek myth of how Demeter, the goddess of the harvest, lost her daughter to Hades for half the year. And she was in mourning. That's why there's a winter time. And when Persephone came back, we have the joy of spring. But during that Persephone period, it's less than 10 hours of day length. So there's not time for the plants to actively grow. You also get the cold temperatures. But after about that 10 hour minimum, even with good temperatures, plants won't do a lot of growing. So your carrot's not going to get any bigger. So what you've probably done already is start with a late crop of carrot seed in August or very early September, and whatever growth they get on them by now is as big as they are going to get. But your question about can you keep the ground from freezing is about insulation. So you've been trying straw, which is a great place to start. But as you've noticed, it does tend to encourage vermin to also make a comfy home where you've provided them with some warmth and some food. But what I'm suggesting is adding a low tunnel, or sometimes called a caterpillar tunnel, because they look like a long white caterpillar, on the landscape. So you can build one of those out of simple material like metal conduit or bent PVC, just to make the hoops, and that will hold up a layer or two of plastic or heavy fabric materials, something that might let a little bit of light in to help warm things up. It'll still let that infrared radiation in, and that can warm the soil and then keep it from freezing at night. And that might give you that couple of months that you're looking for. There are some, I don't know if UW Extension has instructions on building them, but you should be able to Google caterpillar tunnel or low tunnel for instructions on how to build one and how to put it together. But yeah, you just want a couple of layers of insulation to keep those plants, as you said, from freezing. It's absolutely doable.
Janine, good luck with that. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in too. Number to call 1-800-642-1234. Or if you'd like, you could email us. The email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. So that's an option for kind of extending the growing season. Are there other options that we might consider if, you can't have a greenhouse for various reasons?
Yeah, so the low tunnel is definitely one option. One of the first things I learned about even before I was a official horticulture student, a friend's mom said, oh, it's going to frost tonight. And she just went and put sheets over mm-hmm. her outdoor houseplants. And those extra layers of insulation, just like they keep us warm, they keep our plants warm and keep them from losing heat at night. So it's all about layering, which we know as native Wisconsinites. Oh. So some other options you were asking, Larry, a low tunnel or a cold frame can also be heated. So if you have a source of electricity, you can heat a cold frame. You can put in some sort of heating element, either you can get electrical heat mats that people use for germination. Something similar to that can be used to just provide a little extra heat, as well as the enclosure itself. But that's providing a heat source. After a certain point, you need to add some warmth.
Yeah. Vicki in Eau Claire has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Vicki.
Hi, Larry. When we went to the Garden Expo in February, my husband went to the Grow Lettuce in Your Living Room sessions and bought some of the LED lights. We've been having fresh leaf lettuce, fresh basil, microgreens, and for the cost of the LED lights, we've saved so much in produce cost. And he's going to be growing some small bush tomatoes in our basement under LEDs this winter. Doesn't take up much space. We just have shelves and a spare room.
That's great to hear. And you've already, you said, recouped your costs. I mean, sometimes that's a worry. If they're so expensive, how much growth does it take to recover that cost? But it's great to hear that's already happened for you in less than a year.
Yeah. And, grocery prices are up. They're a little higher than we may have been and come accustomed to. And so that helps out as well. Vicki, thanks a lot. Appreciate that call. Mike in Rhinelander, we'll go to you. Hi, Mike.
Hey, good morning, Larry. I heard the call about the carrots in Rhinelander, and I know some old homesteaders, of course, from Rhinelander, know some older homesteaders who've had good luck with that as well over the years. The idea is that you're storing the carrots all winter long. They're biennial. They want to live as long as you keep them from freezing. So if you take a wide bed row of carrots, maybe 2 feet wide by however long, you harvest a section, leave a section, harvest a section, leave a section, and then cover the whole row with straw or leaves. It insulates them, keeps them from freezing. And then in the middle of winter, you can go out there and dig up one of the little sections you left. After you've dug, the frost will get into the ground there, but by leaving a buffer zone where you had harvested a section, the frost can't get over and destroy the next section of carrots. So every month or so, you can go out and dig a patch of carrots, and they did it all winter long up here.
Oh, that's a great story, Johanna.
That is really good. Hadn't thought about leaving the buffer zone.
I like that a lot. Mike, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Well, let's take another call. Bill in Manitowoc. We'll go to you. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I can't top that. I just have an easy question. Are the fish and the plants, are they in separate tanks? Are they together? And then is it filtered or something?
So in our case, the fish and the plants will be in separate tanks. And actually in between them, so there's plumbing that pipes the water from the fish to the plants, but in between there's honestly a third tank that has bacteria in it. So the fish produce ammonia, but the plants can't actually take up ammonia. It needs to be in nitrate form, and it goes through a couple of steps of chemistry to become nitrate, and that is done by bacteria. So there's a third tank in the middle with bacteria in it, and some folks do put all three together in one tank, but for the larger size systems, you really want to have them separated. So we are also going to be employing some nitrosomonas and nitrobacter cultures to help convert that ammonia fish waste into nitrate, which is what the plants prefer to take up.
Oh, Bill, thank you very much for calling. I've been to Epcot in Disney in Florida several times and going through their greenhouses and their aquaponic system. To me, it looks like it's all in one. It's pretty large.
Okay. I haven't been down there, though I know I have a colleague who used to work for them. So maybe sometime we can ask her if that's how it was done.
Yeah,
if you want to really, maximize it and make it most efficient and easy to clean, you're going to want to separate those different steps. But the very earliest aquaponics, we have records of there was a lake in the middle of Mexico City, which fed that city before, which one of the conquistadores was that got there? History's not my forte. But that's how the Aztecs were feeding themselves. Cortez, there we go. And everything was right there in the same place. But you had a very large lake to sort of distribute the nutrients and the fish and the plants through.
Yeah. Sean emailed to ask, what are the inputs for the aquaponic system? Is it just fish food and light, or do you need to fertilize the plants directly as well?
Mostly it is fish food and then some electrical lights, yes. There will be some other nutrients. Obviously, plants cannot live on nitrogen alone. But our water source already provides them with plenty of calcium, as we have very hard water here in Madison. We do occasionally in aquaponics, and this is my first foray, so I don't have a lot of personal experience with them, but I know that iron deficiency is often a problem, so there will be iron supplements that we can give the plants, and occasionally potassium and phosphorus, things like that. But mostly nitrogen is what they need, especially if we're growing leafy greens like lettuces, which is where we're going to start, and then, branch out as we become more comfortable with the system.
Dave in Green Bay emailed us a tip. He found this out by accident a few years ago. And it involves taking your mum plants and keep it in the container, but cut the stems down to get rid of the flowers so they don't shed all over. And then mark what color the mum is. Then place the mum in your garage for the winter, and it will start growing in late winter, and you can transplant it in spring.
Yeah, that's great. I've tried that. It depends on the cultivar of chrysanthemum. I've tried it with some of the ones that I grow as cut flowers, and they live through the winter, but they don't bloom soon enough. They need a longer growing season. So, but you can do that with many of the chrysanthemums that you can get.
Yeah.
But it's just up to you if you want to give up that garden space to something else during the year.
And I think if I was putting it in the garage and it's not an attached garage, I'd probably want to put the pots on top of a wood slab or something that kind of keeps the pot away from the cold cement floor, concrete floor, so that they don't, so it doesn't freeze entirely. Well, what are the plants, somebody's wondering, what are the tropical plants you grow in the D.C. greenhouse?
Oh, we have probably close to 400 different species of tropical plants. We are a teaching greenhouse, so we keep a large houseplant collection with succulents, orchids, many of the common houseplants that you would recognize. We also keep a selection of stock plants for our propagation labs so that we have enough plants for students to cut those up and start new cuttings of, well, today they were working on baby rubber plants and snake plants. And in our conservatory area, we have some of the larger trees that you might see in the shopping malls or large garden centers. And a few that you might not. We have things like cacao and coffee and vanilla for our tropical horticulture and tropical agronomy classes. My favorite tree that's in the conservatory is allspice because its leaves and fruit smell so good.
Yeah, for sure. Have you ever tried or thought of an ice cream banana tree?
I have not tried of that. Ice cream, since it's an animal product, probably isn't going to grow on trees.
Well, the bananas, apparently, these are a more cold-hardy banana.
Okay.
And they have the flavor, apparently, of ice cream, which is why they're called ice cream banana trees.
Wow, I might have to try and get my hands on one of those.
I thought, whoa, that would be something, and they're trees, so it would have to be something that a greenhouse might want to try, but I thought it was pretty cool. And they look a little more ice creamy too. They don't get
as yellow.
Yeah,
oh, interesting.
A shade of or so that's more white. But I thought, oh man, would it be really fun to have one of those?
Yeah, I'm having trouble with my banana trees right now. They aren't getting pollinated. So since our greenhouse has screens on the vents, they were growing outside in the gardens and were getting fruit on them. And then as soon as I brought them in, even though they continued to flower, the flowers didn't set fruit. Because I'm assuming because they weren't getting pollinated. So I'm going to have to either figure out how to do that by hand or find out what does it so that I can get some more banana fruit.
Well, yeah, you're going to have to. Let's see, with the lime tree, I would go by and I would, you can do it by hand on a single tree, but I would also just go by and sort of make, take a piece of paper or something and flutter it back and forth to get the wind going around it. Just to kind of move it around a little bit so that there could be some pollination going on.
I'll set some students on it. That's one of their lab projects. When we grow tomatoes, we have to pollinate the tomatoes. So twice a week, they're out there with paintbrushes moving pollen around.
Oh, man. Joe and Baraboo emailed to ask if there are specific fish breeds that are chosen for their prolific fertilizer output.
you can sort of decide on which fish you want to have, and that was definitely one of the things that I considered. It made me consider goldfish because they are dirty fish. They make their tanks very dirty. They do produce a lot of waste for the feed that they get. I think we've decided to go with tilapia. They are also heavy feeders and heavy waste producers. But yes, when you are growing for aquaponics, when you're growing for leafy greens and other produce, you want to get as much nitrogen into the system as you can. One of the things we were looking at was how our stocking density. So research shows that the more fish you stock in a space, the more waste you get, but at a certain point you get stress on the fish. So finding that balance between good growth, maybe you won't get the best growth, but good growth and good fish husbandry and livestock care, finding that balance was something I had to research as far as, all right, I've got a 100-gallon tank, I have this many plants, how many fish do I need, and what can comfortably fit in that size of a tank. So we are going with tilapia, but I also considered goldfish, and it is one of the things that you take into account is which fish are going to produce more waste for you.
Yeah, I think Disney uses tilapia, and then they feed tilapia to their clients and customers and folks who come to visit Disney. I forget how many hundreds and hundreds of pounds of fish they yeah. serve right from there.
Right, it's a really tight little system.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Johanna,
I should tell you, other reason we went with tilapia is they like warm water. And in growing with hydroponics for the last few years, I've noticed that my water just tends to heat up because we are in a greenhouse, which is a warm space. So the other reason that tilapia and goldfish are popular is they can handle water temperatures of 70 to 75 degrees, whereas other fish like perch or trout would prefer it to be much cooler. So I wanted something that would fit with the environment that I had. I'll get good at doing this, and then we'll, add some complexity to it.
Johanna Oosterwyk, our guest today, instructional manager of the D.C. Smith Greenhouse on the UW-Madison campus. We've been talking a lot about greenhouses and about aquaponics. And we can take other plant questions as well, and I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Johanna Oosterwyk, the instructional manager of the D.C. Smith Greenhouse on the UW-Madison campus. Questions for her? I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org, talking about greenhouses, cold frames, hoop houses, and aquaponics, and certainly we'll take your plant questions as well as we move along. Number to call again, 800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Ellen in Neosho next. Hi, Ellen. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, Larry and Johanna. This is such a great program. I just put up a hoop house last week. It's covered with horticultural plastic, and my questions concern controlling the condensation and preventing algae buildup inside. Do you have some methods for doing that or a resource that I can check into?
So if you've put it up already, check the label or check with the salesperson. Horticultural plastic for greenhouses should offer two sides. So one side, actually on the inside, it can have an extra coating that will reduce condensation. If your plastic that you bought does not have that, you can add an extra coating. And I've forgotten what the brand name is of the material. But you can, if you say bought a kit, go back to your salesperson and ask them for an anti-condensate coating that you can spray on the inside of that plastic material. But first check and see if the plastic that you got doesn't have that coating already. Often the greenhouse plastic will say, this is the inside, this is the outside. The inside for best results should have that anti-condensate coating and also an infrared coating that will keep the, you know, heat energy in the greenhouse. It just gives you a little extra insulation protection. And then on the outside, it can have a coating that will prevent ultraviolet degradation. So you want to be careful when you put it up to put the side that says this side in on the inside and this side out on the outside. So check if your plastic already has that. If you've noticed condensation already, it probably doesn't, but there is a material that you can get to put in a mix into a spray bottle and spray that on the inside. I one time had to do that in our mist house here. So we have a high humidity zone and they had to replace some of the roof panels after a hailstorm. And I'm pretty sure I specified I need no drip panels, but clearly after installation, we were getting some of that dripping, but I used that no drip product and it worked quite well. So,
all right. Something to think
hopefully
about.
That helps you out.
Yeah. Maybe you just have to turn it over.
Well, it's, that would be an awful thing to have to do.
Yes, indeed it would. Ellen, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Mark emailed us a photo, and Joanna, I think you may have access to it, of a...
Yeah, is that the one that Jill sent me over the break?
Yeah,
so
wants to know what this beautiful flower is and plant.
Right. Definitely a cactus, probably an epiphyllum without, you know, doing a little more digging and some research work. It can be hard to give you a more specific identification. Those are really, I think the other part of your question was if it can be propagated, and it should be quite easy to propagate by cuttings. So take one of those stems, break it off at the joint, and put that into a potting mix. You could add some humidity by just closing it up in a plastic bag for a couple of weeks. There should be a little condensation on the inside of the bag, not a lot, because it's a cactus and doesn't want to stay too wet. But under those conditions, it should start to root. And then you've got a whole new plant.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you so much for that photo and that question. Let's talk a bit about plants, indoor plants now, and maybe bringing plants indoors. I actually have a couple of potted plants on my porch that survived so far, but I think it's time to be bringing them in.
It is time, Larry.
So what about bringing, most other people who are smart have already brought their plants inside that they want to keep, but what are some good tips?
Yeah, in a typical Wisconsin fall, we would have brought them in by the beginning of October. My mother was on vacation during September and October, and she emailed me at the end of September and said, have you brought my houseplants in yet? And I said, you know, have you looked at the weather in Wisconsin? She was on the East Coast. And I'm like, we're not getting a frost. But now, since we've had our frost, if your plants are still alive, when you're bringing those in, you know, make sure you have enough space for them. But a couple of things to take into account is expect them to drop some leaves. You can avoid that, especially with things like a weeping fig. They will be very sensitive to light levels, and we get a lot less light inside than we do outside. So the plant is going to drop the leaves that are acclimated to growing outside in high light and put out new leaves that will be better adapted to growing in lower light conditions. So you can, again, looking back a month, you could have prepared your plant for that by bringing it into a shadier location. It takes about 6 weeks to really acclimate a plant. If you haven't done that, be prepared for some leaf drop and realize that the plant's not dying, it's just in shock and it needs to adjust. So cut back on the amount of water. Overwatering at this point could kill the plant. So give it some time, give it about 6 weeks to reacclimate it. Don't stop watering it, but don't keep the soil sopping wet. Kind of, you know, let it dry out a little bit and then add some water. And it should put out new leaves that will be ready to adjust to the lower light inside. So one of the things you have to take into account is that the light levels are going to change. Also, when you bring plants in from the outside, check them over for pests. You don't want to introduce something from outside to your houseplants that maybe stayed inside all year. Often at this time of year, we get white flies and aphids that come along with our plants into the house. A preventive treatment of, say, an insecticidal soap is not a bad idea, especially with white flies and spider mites. Hit those with an insecticidal soap before you bring them in to prevent bringing in pests from the outside. I don't recommend transplanting at this time of year. Again, the plants are going to be growing much more slowly through the winter. I prefer to transplant in the spring when I take them outside and they can, you know, thrive in all that glorious sunshine and put on some weight then. So I prefer not to transplant, but I might do some pruning. Again, keep my plants smaller for inside and knowing that they are probably going to drop some leaves anyway. So now is a good time to do some judicious pruning on your plants as well.
So what about fertilizing? I would think that depends on the plant a bit, but...
It certainly does. When you are bringing your plants in, just like I mentioned with the lower light, the plants are going into shock. So I wouldn't fertilize when you bring them inside. Let them acclimate to the new conditions. Give them a break from your fertilizer treatment. Certainly you fertilize less in the winter than when you would in summer. The plants are not growing as vigorously or as strongly. So cut back on that fertilizer regimen down to, you know, we fertilize the greenhouse plants all year round, but we do it about half as much in the winter as we do in the summer.
Yeah. Do you, somebody was telling me, you know, a good thing to do just in terms of general plant care is to, on some of your succulent plants in particular, if you're, wipe off the leaves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, give them a good dusting and a little extra attention. Since you're bringing them into the house anyway, take the time to look for pests, to dust them off, find any, disease spots or, you know, leaves that were going to die anyway, and give them a little extra attention when you bring them inside.
Ben in Green Bay emailed to ask you to explain the difference between hydroponics and aquaponics.
Yeah, so that difference, I think I explained it a little bit before. Aquaponics is the marriage of hydroponics and aquaculture. So it's really that addition of fish into the system. Hydroponics is growing plants without soil, usually in water and maybe some other type of media. And aquaculture is fish farming. So aquaponics combines those two things into fish and plants all in the same system.
Yeah, it's definitely different, but it's a nice combination if you can do it. I mean, could you have an aquaponic system in your own house?
You could. It would be, you know, probably a pretty small one. But, I mean, as we've seen, you can, if you have a fish tank and you put a plant in that, really that's aquaponics. You're growing fish and plants at the same time. And there are, instructions and worksheets for how you can set up just a little bit of a pump moving water between the tanks, or as we've said, growing them in the same tank all at once. Just make sure that you're in a space where if something gets plugged and you end up with an overflow, water all over the floor isn't going to be a problem.
I wonder if there are, there's probably, you could go online, I'm guessing, you could go online and find a home kit for this.
Yep, you can find a home kit. You can find build your own instructions. I have a student, so my system is not built yet, but I have a student doing an independent study, and they took a couple of 5-gallon buckets and some Rubbermaid totes and some pumps and air stones, and they have a system up and running already.
A couple of 5-gallon bales?
Yep, 5-gallon pails. That's where he's growing his plants. And then the Rubbermaid tubs are on the floor underneath, and that's where the fish are. And then a pump to obviously, you know, pump the fish water up to the plants, and then gravity to bring it back.
Oh, that is pretty darn cool. I love that. Johanna Hoosterwijk is our guest today. Johanna is the instructional manager of the D.C. Smith Greenhouse on the campus of the UW-Madison. Great to have her with us for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining in today. We're talking about extending the growing season on the show today and answering your plant questions as well. Johanna Hoosterwijk, our guest. Johanna is the instructional manager of the D.C. Smith Greenhouse on the UW-Madison campus. What would you like to know about a greenhouse or aquaponics? Do you have a houseplant question that you'd like to have answered? Love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Before we get back to answering those questions, I just wanted to mention again, you know, last week on Garden Talk, we talked about the herb fair that is being held at the Obrick Gardens in Madison, and it is tomorrow. I think it's from 10 to 4. There are 3 primary speakers, but you're going to learn everything you want to know about herbs and probably be able to buy some as well, along with some artwork and so forth, at the Obrick Gardens. The herb fair, again, it's from 10 to 4. If you're in the Madison area, you might want to stop by at Obrick Botanical Gardens. It's a great place to visit anyway. Bethany emailed to ask for your advice on keeping her ferns happy while they are in the house this winter.
Ah, well, it depends on what kind of ferns. There are a number of different species that we use as typical houseplants. I think most important would be to keep them warm and keep them humid. The dry air in our houses can just suck all the moisture out of their fronds and make them kind of grumpy. So if they are dying back and getting brown ends on the leaves, make sure that it's not their spores. Some of them, like the maidenhair fern, will have a little brown line on the underside of the leaf. That's the spores. It's perfectly natural. But see if you can't keep the humidity up around those plants. And you can do that by protecting them from drafts, by creating a little microclimate, by grouping your plants together, or putting them into little Wardian cases or terrariums, or a cloche, something to keep the moist air from blowing away. So yep. Good luck with your ferns.
Jeff in Oshkosh has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Jeff.
Yeah, I was just wondering, I have a Christmas cactus or a Thanksgiving cactus, and it's fairly old. It's well over 40 years old, and it hasn't bloomed for well over 5 years. I was just kind of wondering, what would I have to do to make it bloom? I water it once a week, but not a lot.
So do you have another thing to add on that? Or?
Nope, that's it.
Okay. Yeah, you can tell the difference between a Christmas cactus and a Thanksgiving cactus, first of all, by when they bloom. They're very closely related. Botanists actually put them in the same species. But the Thanksgiving cactus will usually bloom first around late November. And on the edge of the leaf, it has sort of a little claw on the edge of the leaflet. And then the Christmas cactus has a smooth edge, kind of scalloped, not entire, but doesn't have that little claw to it. So that's the first way to tell if you have a Christmas or a Thanksgiving cactus is when do they bloom? And do they have that little extra appendage or claw-like piece jutting out there on the green? To get them to flower, regular watering is important, but they're also sensitive to photoperiod and temperature. So when I force ours to flower in the greenhouse, I usually do leave them outside until just before frost. So those cool nights help them, and also the natural shortening of the day length. So if you have it in a place where the temperature is the same all day long and the light never really varies in day length, that might inhibit them from flowering. You might also, if you're regularly watering but not fertilizing, give them just a little bit of fertilizer every so often with their water too. And good luck.
Yeah, good luck. I had a house. I had a Christmas cactus in my office on the Cal's campus, and it was cool in the evening, and I kept it kind of cool anyway during the day, but it was cool in the evening, and of course the lights were off in the evening, and that thing just flowered like crazy every year.
Yeah.
It was great, and I didn't water it very much either. Oh, man. Jeff, good luck. Thank you. Norman in Wausau, we'll go to you next. Hi, Norman.
Hi. Listen, I have a recurrent problem with scale on my little Meyer citrus plants, and I didn't put them out. The one that's got scale on it wasn't the new ones that I propagated over the summer, but rather on one of the older ones that was inside all summer. So I don't know where the heck they're coming from. Could they be coming from palm trees or cactus or any other plants, or what's the story on that? And then what can you use to spray them with? I've been using a thing that has permethion in it and pyrethrin, and those two things, last year they seemed to kill them okay, but I'm wondering if you got anything better. I tried dormant oil, but I managed to almost kill a lemon plant with it.
Oh. Yeah, it's in the name. Dormant oil you want to use when the plant is dormant, not when it has leaves on it. And citrus, since they're more tropical, aren't going to ever lose all of their leaves at once. Scale are tricky. They're really such an annoying pest. And you're right, they probably just came from another one of your houseplants. They can move around. So the scale that you see, that little brown lump on the leaf, is the adult form of the insect. I know it looks nothing like an insect. The scale is really just an armored coating that the insect underneath has put up to protect itself. And that's why it's so difficult to control. The immatures, we call them crawlers because they crawl around. So they hatch underneath that scale where their mother is, and then they crawl onto someplace else, either on that plant or on a different plant, to find a spot to set up shop and create their own scale. So they definitely probably came from one of your other plants, or if you were treating them before and didn't quite get everything, they might have hatched under a scale where they were protected from that treatment and then crawled out later. So controls, pyrethrin is only effective on those crawlers. The parents are protected from it. So you want something that will get underneath that that protective shield. If you want to eat the citrus, though, that makes it tougher because there are a couple of systemic pesticides. There are some granular powders that have imidacloprid in them that you can put on the soil. The plant will take that up, and as the insects feed, they will eat that, but it will also get into the fruit. So I don't really recommend it for plants that you want to eat. So potentially, if you're going to use something like that, use it when there are no fruit on the plant, and it'll be a few months before you make a harvest. But something with imidacloprid in a granular form that you can apply to the roots as a systemic pesticide can get under that scale, and it will ingest it, whether it's got the armored coating on it or not. Other things you can do, just repeat treatment. So you get those crawlers in every couple of weeks as they hatch, and you can, it takes time, but if you have a small enough plant, you can, you know, pay close attention and wash off the scale when you see them. You can do that with a little bit of dilute alcohol, so isopropyl or ethyl alcohol, something to wash off the scale and hopefully kill any of those crawlers or eggs that are remaining. But scale are just an annoying pain in the neck for those of us who want to keep good, healthy houseplants.
I hate them. I hate them. Mm-hmm. Norman, thanks for calling. Good luck. Mike in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I have I believe it's a Schefflaria. It's about 20 years old, and it's gotten big, long, and leggy, and I need to trim it back. Do I just, because it's got, you know, like foot-long, two-foot woody sections with no growth on it, just do I just cut it below where the growth is and then hit it with rooting hormone and stick it in soil?
Yes, you can absolutely try rooting it that way. You could also, if you want, try air layering, which doesn't take a rooting hormone. You score the stem where you want the new roots to grow and then pack it in sphagnum moss and with a layer of plastic around that. So air layering works well for Schefflera. If you can basically get it to root along the stem. You can do that if you want new plants and then you want to get rid of the old one, or you should be able to cut it back. So wherever you have taken a cutting, it will, so long as it has a viable node below that point, it should branch out. So it sort of depends on what you want to do with it. They're pretty flexible as far as what you can do to propagate those. You can either, you know, cut the whole thing back, and or you can take cuttings, or you can do an air layer to get new plants. So you've got some options there.
Yeah. Mike, thanks for calling. You can join in too, 1-800-642-1234, our number, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. Matt in Alloway called, couldn't stay with us, but he has had success with Christmas cactus by putting them in a corner window and keeping them in a constricted pot, keeping them kind of pot-bound. What do you think? It sounds like it's working for him.
Yeah, certainly is. They don't mind being a little bit pot-bound. I would guess it has more to do with being close to the windows and getting that chilling at night.
Yeah, that's probably correct. What do you think is the easiest houseplant? Let's say I want to buy a houseplant. Bromeliads, maybe? What do you think are the easiest ones to grow?
I would say snake plants. They take a lot of abuse and neglect. They don't need much light, and you don't have to repot them very often. We just repotted our snake plants that are part of our teaching collection, and they were busting out of the pots, but still doing great. So if you want a plant that you don't have to water very often, doesn't have too many pest problems, I think the worst thing I have with them is mealybugs once in a while. But it, you know, they're not the first plants that they show up on. Folks like pothos for easy care houseplant, and yes, they grow well and they don't like a lot of light, but I have so many mealybug problems on the pothos. If I could I would convince the instructors not to keep them around the greenhouse, because if I need mealybugs, I know where to find them. And sometimes I do if I want to show students what they look like.
So. Oh man, Dot in Chippewa Falls, we'll go to you. Hi, Dot.
Hi. Let me turn the radio down. Sorry. I have a Hindu rope plant.
Mm-hmm.
Another name for it is Parnosa compacta.
Yes.
And it's like at least 20 feet long.
Hmm.
And I want to know exactly how to get some cuttings off of it and start new plants. I think you got to cut either. I think it's below the node, right? Or above?
Yes, you'll want to. So the node is where the leaf joins the stem. And that's where new roots are most likely to come out. But you, as you probably noticed, you have lots of leaves. So I would cut it below a leaf, leave a little bit, a couple of inches of stem, and then that can get inserted into a propagation mix to start a new plant. I mean, you can also cut it back and it should branch out like that Schefflera below the cut. But if you want to take cuttings of your rope plant, you can just cut it into sections, maybe 4 to 6 inches long, have a little bit of bare root, lace that into your potting mix, and then you'll want to keep it humid for a couple of weeks while those new roots grow. Since the plant can't take up water without roots, you want to keep it from drying out. So something simple to do at home is you could either get a tray for the propagation mix and a humidity dome to put over that tray. You can get those at most garden centers. Then give it moderate light, not bright light, because in a bright window, it will heat up too much in that area, just like your car sitting in the sun. So you can take it just a couple of lengths, lower that down, that cut end down into the soil, and keep it humid. If you don't want to go out and buy a potting tray and a humidity dome, you can also just take some pots, fill those with a loose potting mix, and wrap a clear plastic bag around those to keep up the humidity for, 4 to 6 weeks while the new roots grow.
Dot, there you go. Sounds like you're doing a pretty good job, Dot, with your Hindu rope is 20 feet long. That's pretty good. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Cindy in Antioch, Illinois, on to you. Hi, Cindy.
Yes, I have a Norfolk pine in my living room that's heading towards the ceiling. It needs to be, it's just getting way too tall. And I do have, it's multi-stemmed. I have two stems that are coming out of the one root. So okay. Any ideas on cutting it back without killing it?
So go ahead and cut back that one tallest stem, if that's the one that's giving you problem. Unlike some of our other plants, it's a conifer or a type of pine, and it's not, you don't want it to branch out. You want that nice pine tree shape. So I think the simplest thing to do would be to remove that largest stem and let the other two or even one take over. I know we get multi-stemmed ones now. We used to only get single-stemmed ones. It has to do with how they are produced. About 25 years ago, we only got them from seed. So you would just have one stem. And now most of them are produced through microculture as cell cultures. And now you get a whole bunch of little stems together. But you kind of have to decide which one's going to be the leader. And if the leader in your case is too tall, you could cut that one down. It will probably make it significantly shorter. But the other two should be fine without it.
All right. Cindy, good luck. Thank you. Let's go to Ann in Waldo next. Hi, Ann.
Hi, how are you?
Great, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to just share with you that I was fortunate enough to sell plants on the street corners of Washington, D.C. when I was in college, and I fell in love with plants. But I want to disagree with your guest there. I think the most wonderful plant to give people is the peace lily.
Yes, that is also an excellent option. Peace lily is
just
good
because
too.
It's, yes, I just snake plants are just to me just not very attractive. But no, I
but
love
they're
them.
Easy. Yeah, the question was, what's the easiest houseplant?
Yeah, but peace lilies. Anne's right. I mean, peace lilies are attractive. They're not hard to grow.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're onto something there, Anne. Thank you for calling. Lisa in Crivets, we go to you. Hi, Lisa.
I just had a tip on starting plants or starting seeds. It's an easy method to keep them, the humidity and everything. I buy rotisserie chickens from a certain convenience store in the area, and they have they're not huge, but they're reasonable sized, and they have a black plastic tray on the bottom that's about 3 or 4 inches deep, and then they have a clear dome over the top, and it's slightly vented, but it allows light in, it keeps the humidity up, and I find that to be the absolute perfect environment to start seeds or to root small plants. It won't work with larger ones, but it's great for small stuff.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I personally use deli containers to make terrariums because they're cheap. So I buy a sleeve of 2-pound deli containers and lids. There are lots of things that you can use. Like I said, you know, we're doing aquaponics in 5-gallon buckets and Tupperwares.
Well, that is, I like that idea. I hadn't thought about that with the rotisserie chicken. But Lisa's,
and you get dinner.
Yeah, you get dinner out of it as well. Lisa, thanks so much. Appreciate that. I love that idea. Somebody else was wondering about orchids. Do you raise many orchids in the greenhouse?
We have a small collection, really just what we need for teaching with, since we have a plant ID class. So if there's a little bit of a hole in my knowledge, I'm not extensively experienced with orchids, but I can keep them alive.
I had pretty good luck with ficus, too, and keeping it going year-round, ficus plants. And they're easy to, they're relatively easy to care for, aren't they?
They are, and they're some of the most popular indoor trees. So we don't let them grow as much as they could in our homes. As she was saying with the Norfolk pine, it's getting too tall. But you were enjoying the conservatory. 80% of the trees in our indoor conservatory garden area are different kinds of ficus. We've got the weeping fig, we've got the fiddle leaf fig, we've got saber fig, and a couple of others as well. Because they are tropical trees, they don't mind lower light conditions, and because they take pruning really, really well, they are easy to grow indoors. You'll find them in most indoor, you know, shopping centers, or you'll find quite a few of them here on campus in places like the WID, or they're building a new computer science building that should have some indoor plantings and already planning ahead for some of those ficus.
Joanna, excuse me, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it. We'll look forward to another visit.
Thanks for inviting me. It's always great to be with you, Larry.
Joanna Oosterwijk is the instructional manager of the D.C. Smith Greenhouse. And by the way, we have some links, have a link to the greenhouse on our the Larry Mueller Show site. Go to ideas at WPR.org/Larry and go to today's date. And there's a link to the greenhouse and the aquaponics site there. So look forward to having you take a look at that as well. Next week on Garden Talk, Laura Jowell will be back to help you with your tree, shrub, and woody perennial questions, so I hope you can join us for that. And on Monday, we'll take a look at Wisconsin's first school teacher. In the meantime, I hope you have a great weekend. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.